Minority Caucus Chair Millen, will you please come up here?
Representative Kraft, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Madam Minority Caucus Chair.
Do you want to call him to order?
You have privilege of the floor.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a wonderful intern from Western Wyoming Community College that I know a lot of you have met. She's helped a lot of you. She's up in the gallery, Susie Scholler, but with her are her interns in training. We have Eric, who's 7 years old, and Bobby, who's 5, and their daddy, Tom Scholler, and they're going to be our interns in just a couple of years from Western Wyoming. Please.
Welcome to the Wyoming House of Representatives. Thank you for being here. Representative Zwanether.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Can I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you. Members of the legislature in the South Gallery, you'll see this year's state FFA officer team. They're the ones wearing those snazzy blue jackets from all over Wyoming here to visit today. Please make them feel welcome.
Thank you to our future farmers for being here. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution Number 4. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution Number 4, introduced by Representative Gingrey. A joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to remove any mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices and judges of other courts. This bill was sent to the Judiciary Committee, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Lickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. It was further referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, excused, Philp. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 4 do pass, and I further... there's no standing committee amendments. That's it. This bill deals with the Constitution and amending the Constitution and potentially placing on the 2010 ballot a... ballot proposition to amend the Wyoming Constitution. If you look on the second page of the bill, Article 5, Section 5 of the Wyoming Constitution says that when a judge becomes the age of 70, they must retire. It's a mandatory retirement age. The difficulty with this is that many of our judges, number one, get appointed late in life. Maybe their late 50s, in their 60s. It takes a few years to get good at what they're doing. As soon as they become really good judges and their wisdom is emanating from the bench, the difficulty is that then we tell them, you must step down. Not because any of their mental faculties have gone away, but because solely because of an arbitrary age number. Now, so we had to go back and find out how did this get into the Constitution. And one of the issues is that, there's a law review article that recently came out in the Wyoming publication talking about this. And in the article, they refer to it as statutory senility. The concept that at the age of 70, the idea was that automatically people go senile at the age of 70. Well, clearly that is wrong. And not only is it offensive to our judges by having this in the Constitution, it's offensive to all others who are still working at whatever profession they work at, who are over the age of 70. We need to fix this offensive language and remove it from the Constitution, and to allow judges that so choose to choose when they will retire. So then the first question becomes, well, if this was put in to remove judges that potentially were having mental facility issues on the bench, how would you remove a judge that has an issue? And before I get to that, let me make it clear. You could be younger than 70 and start having mental issues. You could be 50. And so there needs to be a mechanism to remove that judge. The mechanism, and we took a lot of testimony in committee from commission. There is a Commission on Judicial Ethics and Conduct. This is actually a commission that was created in the 90s by constitutional amendment. It's actually in the Constitution that this commission will exist. And this commission exists of 12 people. There are 3 judges, 3 attorneys, and 6 electors who are neither attorneys or judges. Of those 12, when they have a report of an issue, so let's say just a litigant reports them or maybe a citizen reports, they split up, the 12 split up. 6 of them become an investigatory panel, and 6 of them become an adjudicatory panel. The investigatory panel looks into the allegations and determines whether or not there is something to pursue. The investigatory panel then turns it over to the adjudicatory panel. There is a hearing in which evidence is taken. This is all confidential. And then if it turns out that they determine that this judge should be removed from the bench, that is given up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court makes the decision whether or not to remove or not to remove. And also in that same constitutional provision, if it happens to be a Supreme Court justice that is being discussed, there's a special provision that a panel of district court judges are brought in to determine the Supreme Court justices whether or not the mental facilities are an issue. It's split in the states. About half the states have some age limit. Vermont goes all the way up to 90. At 90, they say you have to. And about half the states don't have an age limit. It's just handled through something similar to what I just described that we created in the 90s, this Commission on Judicial Conduct and Ethics. So we clearly have a tool available to remove a judge if issues do arise. There is no need to have an arbitrary age. I would just draw your attention, because there is an appropriation on this bill of $32,000. I couldn't figure out why in the world it costs $32,000. We have a rule that if it's a constitutional ballot question, they have to be published in every county in the state for 12 consecutive weeks. So that adds up, because each line costs so much. So that's the entire joint resolution, and I would stand for any questions.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to speak in favor of this for 2 reasons. Number one, it's very difficult for someone to accumulate enough personal net worth that they don't need the state retirement. If they do need their state retirement, then that the vesting period for the state retirement is going to define when that person can become a judge. With a mandatory age of 70, until we made the changes we made here recently, it was 20 years to fully vest. And I had a younger fellow that I was partners with for many years. He's been a city judge for many, many years. And I was talking to him over at a basketball game, and he said, I woke up on my 50th birthday and thought, well, I'll never be a judge. And I don't think that's right. Now, we did change it, so there's some factor in there that now that can cut it down to 12 years. But I just hate to see that pool of people who maybe have practiced law for a long time, have the maturity and the experience to be judges, but they've passed that magical entry age of age 50 or at the best 58, and they could give us 5 or 10 years of really good service as a judge. So I think that by removing the mandatory retirement age, we also remove that artificially induced entry age, which I think is important. The other thing is, I have a lot of confidence in the ability of the committee that the sponsor spoke about to take care of judges who may need to leave office. And when I was president of the bar, I made appointments to that and oversaw that. And if anybody has doubts, I'll be happy to have a confidential conversation with you and share some experiences that I've had. But I believe that it works, and I believe that we don't need to worry about someone becoming senile on the bench and virtually no remedy available to get them off of there if they no longer can serve the way that they should. So I'm very much in favor of this bill and would urge your favorable consideration.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want everybody here to understand that I was accused this morning of being present at the signing of the Magna Carta. I deny that. I was not there. I suspect the person that made the charge might have mistaken me for somebody British or something. I don't know where that came. However, as it comes to the subject that we have at hand, I was the prime sponsor for how the judicial selection of the judiciary was going to take place, and took that position as taking away the election process and having the process that we have now. I had a conversation relative to the term of retirement of age 70, and I have to tell you that I was in favor of the age of 70 because the other two people that were involved at that time in that discussion were suggesting that the common age was 65. Now I find myself in the position of having the audacity of having passed the retirement, mandatory retirement age and running for public office to sit in judgment of the judges. So with full support and embarrassment of my longevity, I am in support of what we are doing here. Secondly, when the constitutional amendment was changed, I was an advocate of the constitutional change that brought about the addition and change of the judicial conduct and ethics and served the first 6 years of that. And I can attest to the fact that that group, although everything is confidential, so I kind of wondering what conversation with Kermit, with the representative just spoke. Relative to what we might be able to talk about, I can tell you they're hardworking, they're honest, they are very, very committed to the judiciary and its integrity, and the investigatory body in the case of the Supreme Court has no hesitancy at all in having the district court judges be selected as the adjudicatory portion of that effort. I can't tell you enough about how those people work and how much I support them. So I think that we're in good shape, and to remember that irrespective of all of these other things, a justice must run and be selected by the public, once again, irrespective of his age. So there's always that challenge, there is always that test that will remain and still be there when and if and as this passes. Thank you.
Chairman Inouye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for HJ4, you know, it's time we did this, and if you think back, we have, if the feds had done that and had a mandatory retirement age at 70, one of the finest district court judges who is still on the bench in the federal court, who has made some of the best decisions for Wyoming, would have retired about 15 years ago, and we would not have had the benefit of some of those decisions, which have been excellent for the state of Wyoming, for land use and so forth. So on and for this amendment, on and for the bill and the following, just because we need some of these minds. Now, when you get to some of the other ones that, you know, some of the attorneys, maybe we ought to limit them to 65, but the judges is fine.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to add a little bit about the Magna Carta and the author of that. It wasn't true that the good senator or good representative was a signatory to that, but I know he knew many of the people that did put it together. And I also want to call your attention. There's a lot of history of this particular problem right here in these chambers. The good representative from Campbell County, his father was the president of the Bar Association. At the same time, I was practicing with the former Governor Sullivan's father in Douglas, or in that town up in Converse County. I've got to get used to doing this, excuse me. In any event, at the time that law, the what they call the Missouri Plan, came into effect and how we picked our judges, and I thought it was a marvelous way of doing things. And as young as I was, I got President Lubnow at the time, the president of the Bar Association, appointed me as a member of the Judicial Nominating Committee. He's deceased. This would be the late president of the Bar. And he appointed me as what they called a man Friday to serve on that committee on the very first judicial nominating process. And it was a wonderful process. And then 35 years later, I was appointed to be on the board of the Judicial Nominating Committee. And I want you to know that I know the age of 70, 75, 80, a lot of people have talked about just bumping it up. But in the federal judiciary, there is no limit. And so we do have a problem, perhaps, but there's no mechanism for removal other than impeachment. In ours, we not only have the re-election process that you can use, but we also have the commission that the good representative from Albany County discussed with you. This is a good bill, and I want you all to support it, and I'd like to see us be able to hang on to the best of our judges for as long as we can. Thank you very much.
Are you ready for the question? Okay. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution Number 4 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Joint Resolution Number 4 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 37. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 37, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act relating to judicial retirement.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 37 do pass. Mr. Chairman, this looks just like the bill you just looked at, except it's a little different. Here's the issue. We, in the Constitution, we have this provision about 70, but we also wrote it in statute. So we have to take it out of the statutes also. But you can't take it out of the statute unless the constitutional amendment passes. So the key part of this bill is over on page 2, where it says this act is effective only if the electors adopt a constitutional amendment at the 2010 general election repealing any mandatory age for justices and judges. And so that would resolve that.
Question having been called.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, there's a standing committee amendment. Is that right?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I forgot there was an amendment. I moved the standing committee amendment number 1, and it was just a typo. On page 2, line 6, it said, as provided in 2010 House Joint Resolution 1, it should be House Joint Resolution 4.
Okay. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Okay. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Are you ready for the question? Question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 37 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 37 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 12. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 12, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to juvenile detention facilities admissions criteria. This bill was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary, who recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Throne. No, Peasley, excused, Korberg. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 12 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. The Standing Committee Amendment, if you look over on page 4 and then it gets repeated on 7, this issue was page 4, line 10. Oh, yeah. So there was a provision in this bill that said if you take a minor into custody, you need to release that minor back to his parents and give notice, or if you don't release him back to the parents, if you're going to take him into custody, give notice to the parents that you took their kid. And so should there be a time period as to when you tell the parent you took their kid? The original bill that we worked on over the summer was 12. We got some testimony from sheriffs and chiefs that 12 was too short. They needed more like 24 because sometimes it's difficult for them to track parents down. They gave the example of a house party or something on the weekend where they've left the kids and the parents have gone away and they can't find the parents. So they thought that should be longer. So the committee made an amendment to switch the 12 to 24 hours.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
In your box should be a handout that's titled House Bill 12, Juvenile Admissions Tool. Where this came from was over the interim, the Judiciary Committee dealt with juvenile justice issues. Two bills came out of that. One has started in the Senate, and this one started over here. But these are the two bills the committee came up with to deal with some of the juvenile issues that we were asked to tackle during the interim. What this deals with is what's called pre-adjudication. So this is before a kid has been convicted of anything. This is the issue of picking up a kid at 2 in the morning for whatever crime he's committed. And the officer has to determine what to do with that kid. So the first option, of course, is always to try to find the parent and deliver the kid up to the parent and maybe issue a citation and say, you know, you need to bring your kid in, you know, next week to his court hearing. Or sometimes they don't even cite. They just, you know, don't do that again. But in other cases, it may be a little bit more serious. And the issue became as to the distinction between what's called hardware secure and staff secure. Hardware secure is like bars clanging, that type of thing. Staff secure is more of a dormitory style situation. And the state is moving toward a system. There are multiple hardware secure facilities around the state, but not every county needs one. They're very expensive to build. So what we're trying to create is a regional system of hardware secure. And then in the smaller communities, there'd be staff secure. And in my own community, it's a modular. It's just a modular that looks like a little house. And in that modular, the kids stay there. Now, who should be in the hardware secure? Well, we took a lot of testimony from experts, and really who should be going in hardware secure are those that are a threat to society. So someone who has committed a violent crime, murder, rape, or some other violent crime of that type. Other than that, they should be held in a staff secure type facility. So what this has to do with, so that gives you the background of how we got to this point. Then we came up with what many states have moved toward is what's called an admissions tool. This is for the officer, and it's usually a one-pager. It's a one-page document. The officer has it in his squad car. He pulls out the one sheet, and he answers about 4 or 5 different questions. And each state seems to have their own little form, but they all seem to ask the same questions. There are questions like, was this a violent crime? Yes. score 15. Is he a repeat offender? Yes, score 15. Or no, score 0. Is there a warrant or a standing order from the judge to immediately incarcerate if you find this kid? Well, then that's automatic. You need to hold him in a hardware secure. So what the officer does then is adds up the numbers. If the number is a high number, then it gives him the idea. He doesn't have to follow the number, but it at least suggests to the officer that maybe this person should be in a hardware secure facility, or if it's a lower number, it gives them the idea that they should be in a staff secure facility. This is, again, just a tool. Now, why do they even need this? What we're trying to guard against is subjective and not, well, we want objective, not subjective. Got the two confused. You want to be able to not say, and one of the best examples we heard was from a prosecutor who said he gets the call at 2 in the morning and all he hears is the last name of the kid. Well, that kid, that last name he associates with kids, that family, usually always are in trouble, and he says, oh yeah, just lock them up. Well, this could be that one kid in that family that's the straight A kid. And subjectively, we've just put him in a hardware secure where he may not have needed to be in a hardware secure. So by using this tool, he would say, oh, you know, my numbers actually aren't adding up to place him in a hardware secure. I should maybe place him in a staff secure facility. So it takes away the subjectivity and hopefully puts in some objectivity. It also is sort of CYA to the officer that if someone ever challenges the officer, he can say, well, you know, my score came up to this. But what's also important to know is that the assessment tool can be overridden by the officer if he just says, boy, that number is wrong. I know this kid. He needs to go or he doesn't need to go. So the tool is just a tool. It's not automatic. When we originally wrote this bill, we had DFS coming up with the assessment tool. Nobody liked that idea. So we changed it. We had long meetings with the sheriffs and chiefs. And the sheriff is going to come up with the assessment tool that is tailored to the local needs of that community. So each sheriff will come up with their own, and they're actually already working on this issue and will have their own assessment tool. And it's not that difficult for them to come up with it. They're in a lot of states. What they really need to do is just sit down and look at the different examples and say, I like that one or I don't like that one. I think I'll combine these two, whatever they want to do. So that's the assessment tool and how it works. And I would tomorrow on second reading, I'll bring another amendment. The prosecutors were concerned. There's a section in there. A minor under the age of 11 shall not be held in a hardware secure. There was concern, what do you do if you're a small town, you have no other option. So we have some language that may take care of that issue. So we'll deal with that. I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question that arose as I was looking through this, in both the sections that deal with notification to the parent and guardian, where we just changed it from 12 to 24, just trying to think through the situation where you may have a minor that, I mean, they just don't have a guardian or a parent around. Some of these kids that get in the system may have families that are fractured such that it is just impossible to track anybody down. Wondering if the committee spoke about that and how that situation works under the language of the bill currently, where there's really a mandate to find somebody within that 24-hour period.
Chairman Gingrey?
The committee did discuss that, and there's really no cause of action back against the sheriff for failing to comply. So it's more of a strong suggestion to the sheriff that within that time period, but if he fails, what we talked about was that the sheriff just needs to document it really clearly. I really tried, I looked, and there doesn't seem to be anyone in charge of this kid. And in that case, he would probably become a CHINS case anyway and be transferred to the custody of DFS if we're not able to find someone that seemed to have any control over this kid. But we certainly talked about that because, you know, this provision was a little controversial because what happens if the officer can't find somebody? That's an excellent point.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 12 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 12 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 13. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 13, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to alcohol, creating an offense for persons under the age of 21. This bill was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Throne. No, Peasley, excused, Korberg. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 13 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. The Standing Committee amendment, when we worked this over the summertime during interim, one of the things we did, we stuck in ethyl alcohol everywhere, and it turned out we made a little mistake this summer. We didn't have to put it everywhere. It was just in one place we needed to put it. And so we need to go back to the original language throughout the bill where it says alcoholic liquor or beverage. And I think there was another part of that amendment. We changed the parental exception so it doesn't apply to liquor establishments. And we deleted J, which dealt with prima facie evidence, which was an issue with some of the chiefs and sheriffs who testified. That's what the Standing Committee amendment does.
You heard the motion on the standing, Chairman McComey. Oh, never mind. you've heard the motion on the Standing Committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a committee sponsor bill. I tried to find someone on my committee that so I wouldn't be up here all afternoon, but they said I'd do a good job, so they sent me up here. What the present law says, it's one long run-on sentence, and that's part of the problem is that you have one long run-on sentence, and it gets difficult to parse it into pieces. So if you look at the top of the handout, I gave you a handout that says House Bill 13, underage drinking. If you look at the very top of that handout, it shows you the present law. And what happens is within that one long run-on sentence, you actually have two separate crimes being discussed. One is the crime of possession of alcohol, and one is the crime of consumption of alcohol. So sometimes the officer will just write 12-6-101 on a citation, and you don't know what you're actually being charged with. Were you being charged with possession of alcohol, or were you being charged with consumption of alcohol? So one thing this bill does, first of all, is it separates out the crimes clearly and distinctly so that you know exactly what you're being charged with. And you'll see that on page 2 of the bill. So if you look at on page 2, subsection C, you have Romanette 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and each one is a separate and distinct crime, and so it makes it clear. The second thing the bill does, it cleans up this issue of exceptions. There are exceptions in the current law. However, and this is really a big part of what this bill's doing, is dealing with we have a myriad of different interpretations across the state by judges on how to interpret this statute. Because it's such a poorly written statute, it's caused a lot of confusion. And what we don't want to happen is that one kid in one city in this state is being treated one way because that judge reads the statute a certain way, and then a kid in a different town is treated a completely different manner because that judge reads it differently. So then you don't have consistency and fairness in your judicial system. So a large part of what this bill does is makes our judicial system a fair and consistent utilized. So one area where that comes in is in this issue of exceptions. And there was some confusion as to the exceptions, so we clearly delineated each exception, and you'll see that and we separated them out. So subsection D is dealing with exceptions for both possession and consumption. And then subsection E is just dealing with possession. So what's the difference between possession and consumption? Consumption is you've actually taken the alcohol into your body. Possession is you're just standing there holding a beer in your hand. That's the distinction. So the exceptions for consumption and possession are if you're in your parents' presence, it's a church activity, meaning you're taking Mass at a Catholic service, medicinal purposes. Those are your exceptions for consumption. Now, the new part of this is, in the current law, the exception for parent is only with possession, not with consumption. And this was hotly debated during the committee meetings this summer, if we should expand the parental exception from the current law of just possession to include also consumption. And we went ahead and did it, but we can certainly discuss that because that's certainly a new aspect to the law as to this parental exception. As to the exceptions that only apply to possession, which are in subsection E on page 3, it's when you're delivering, when it's part of your employment, when you're serving, when it's part of your employment, you're a waiter. Or lastly, the one I always enjoy, if you're a licensee, and what had happened in that case, that was actually a statute that had to get passed. A young man had inherited a bar that had a liquor license with it. And so the law was changed for that purpose. So those are the exceptions. The other thing the bill does, it solves this. One of the major things it does is it solves the issue of what's called the Tanner, Bush, May trilogy of cases. And what those three cases, they all deal with the same subject matter, but they all deal with the word or. And they mostly deal with burglary cases. And what was happening was prosecutors would take a statute and say, in their information, they would say, you are guilty of, and they would list all the things you're guilty of, but they put ors in there, because that's how we wrote it in the statute. Well, the court came back and said, but the person really doesn't know what you're accusing them of because you put a bunch of ors. They don't know if it was this one or that one. For example, with burglary, were you burglarizing that home for the purpose of larceny or for the purpose of killing somebody? Because those are two different elements of a crime in burglary. And the prosecutor needs to distinguish what was the intent of the burglar. The burglar was committing larceny or the burglar was trying to kill you. That's what the trilogy of cases deals with, Tanner, Bush, May. Where it comes into play here is that the judges have started interpreting, and if you look back at the language that we presently have, it says alcoholic liquor or malt beverage. Well, when you look at the two definitions for alcoholic liquor is things like vodka, gin, things like that. Malt beverage is beer. So the judges said, if you charge consumption, because possession is real easy, it's whatever they're holding in their hand. If it's consumption, that the prosecutor had to prove which it was. Was he drinking beer or was he drinking vodka? And the prosecutor had, it was a very difficult thing to prove which of the two had the person consumed. So this bill fixes that problem of consumption. The other thing this fixes is there's confusion as to consumption enforcement on private property. And here's how this plays in. The best example is this. So an officer gains access into a private residence, lawfully, either in the best example, usually with kids, they invite you in, actually. So the officer is invited into the party. The officer looks around, and here's what he sees. He sees one kid standing off to the side holding a beer in his hand. That kid can be cited because possession can occur in any location. It can be private or public. So the kid holding a beer gets cited for possession of alcohol. The kid on the other side of the room that is not touching any alcohol, he has no beer in his hand, and there's none near him, but he's fall down drunk. He may be even passed out. That young man cannot be cited in the state of Wyoming. The officer can't cite him because consumption of alcohol by a minor is only illegal in a public place. And actually, we say street or highway. We've had cases where the kid will be drunk standing on a sidewalk, and the kid steps into somebody's front yard, not even his own front yard, just steps into a front yard off the sidewalk. Now suddenly he is not committing a crime anymore, and he can fall and pass out there on that front lawn, and there's not much we can do about it. So the issue becomes whether or not you want consistency. Are we going to be, because here's where the kids complain. They say, well, this isn't fair. Just because I was too stupid to set down my beer and I held on to it when you walked into the party, I got cited, but my buddy was a little smarter than me and dropped the beer, he does not get cited. That, again, is unfairness, and it's not consistent application of the law, and that's something we need to improve. That is the bill that we worked on this summer, and I think there's some amendments to come.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 13 and ask for its favorable introduction. Some brief thoughts on the bill so I can merge into the amendment here. The bill was kind of explained that it was a rewrite and a cleanup to make our laws, more perfect and easier for law enforcement to understand. But I think when I read through it, it's a great furtherance of the current law. We talked about the same fairness of treatment across the board. But listen to that. I think it jumps the standard to the strict end of what's currently going on as opposed to the weak end of the spectrum. And I know our laws don't always work. And in this case, we have this problem with 18 to 21-year-olds. I explained to this on an introduction that, these kids can own property. They can own their own house at this age. They have a lot of allowances, I would say, once you hit that 18-year-old point, especially if you're in a college town or go to a university or et cetera. My amendment, therefore, and the sponsor talked about this briefly, when we rewrote the current statute as we are here, we're taking out the words on any street, highway, or any public place. And so what I'm attempting to do on page 2 is insert that language back on just 3 of the classifications. So if you look at Romanets 3, 4, and 5, that's where you'd add on any street, highway, or public place. Still, it doesn't affect Romanet 1, the purchase or attempt to purchase of any alcohol, or to Romanet 2, soliciting another person to purchase alcohol on your behalf. However, it does take it back to what I believe is the current standard of possession, consumption, or having measurable blood, breath, or urine concentration in your body. There's a couple caveats in this bill. I'm not exactly sure how certain terms go into place. If you look on page 3 at Romanet 1, you have to be in the physical presence of a parent, spouse, or legal guardian, and you can consume alcohol. Physical presence, I don't think, is defined well in Wyoming law. If you're in the same room, you're in the same couch, you're in the same house, if you just leave your parents' house, if you start to drive home. Same with the church service. If you can drink the church service, but then you walk out the church service door, can they pull, get you right outside if you're under 21 as you walk out of communion every Sunday. Anyway, I'm asking for... on Romanets 3, 4, and 5 to be reintroduced the way the statute currently reads. I know it's not perfect. I don't think our current alcohol laws are perfect. We have a thing called the Amicus Institute that started 3 years ago that 135 college presidents have signed on to across this country, saying that we need to have a serious talk about alcohol laws for this age group because things aren't working. I expressed some concern on introduction that binge drinking is currently the problem in this age group. It's not drunk driving anymore. Drunk driving laws are great. The punishments are great. They've worked. All the studies say they're going down. In the inverse, all the studies say that binge drinking is going up. And I think by doing what the sponsor attempted to do on this bill, or the committee is attempting to do on this bill, isn't going to help that problem. So I'd ask you to at least leave it at the same standard of care by accepting my amendment and stand for questions.
We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Is there any discussion? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few concerns. This actually doesn't take us back to where we are in present law. This actually drastically changes the current law, because in current law, again, possession can be anywhere in the state, public or private. It's consumption that has to be in a public situation. What this amendment does, it does both. It does possession and consumption. So essentially what that would mean is that the present law would be erased also. So I think the intent maybe of the bringer was to just do consumption, which would have been the one on line 17. I'm not sure if he meant to do possession also, because that changes the current law even further. As to whether or not it should be, if kids should be allowed to drink in private, essentially what this comes down to, this amendment, is dealing with the issue of if kids are having a party, a private party in a hotel room, or parents are out of town, is that going to be legal? Are we just going to leave that alone? And what the officers testified to is, if you tell us that's what you want, we understand. Because right now, most of them are saying, listen, this thing's impossible to enforce anyway. We're tired of going citing kids. They easily get out of these cases because the law is written so poorly. So if the legislature doesn't want to enforce underage drinking, the officer said, that's fine. Just let us know that so we don't put our time toward it. And that's what this does. I mean, they're saying, you know, if it's just public places in any street or highway is what it says there, then that'll be what it is. And we won't go anymore to private residences for these party calls. As to the issue of 19, 20-year-olds, this is not what this bill is dealing with. Someone could bring that bill to lower the drinking age. What we tried to work on this summer was the issue of not on the age, but rather just cleaning up the bill so it could be enforceable. Because the primary language we heard again and again from judges and from law enforcement and from prosecutors was that the present law is almost very difficult to enforce. So if binge drinking is something that you want them to enforce and to stop, they'll do it, but you got to give them the tool to do it, and they certainly don't have the tool now. I would urge you to vote no on the amendment.
We're on Committee of the Hall Amendment number 1. Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you. Just to clarify, Mr. Speaker, that is my intent on 15 and 17 for both possession and consumption. I know we talked about age groups. 8 and 21-year-olds aren't kids in my mind. I guess this does affect everyone under 21, but we put in some other laws in place in this body for house parties, for people under 18. They're in minor, the statute's on minors, et cetera. So I do think this bill really is much more targeted to the 8 and 21-year-olds, and I don't think most of them would appreciate being called kids. And I guess I wonder, in the wisdom of this body in the past, that perhaps this law was written, as the good committee chairman says, poorly or vaguely on purpose, because this is a tough area, and it's been a tough area for 30 years. So I would ask you to vote for my amendment. I don't think it drastically disrupts the bill or kills the intent or takes our laws back to, you know, the time after Prohibition or anything. So thank you.
Any more discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment fails. There's a second Committee of the Whole amendment. Oh, other representatives wanted to, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to House Bill 13. This amendment would be found on page 3, basically between lines 10 and 15. I consider it a friendly amendment. The amendment has to do with the exceptions of when someone is a minor and they have a blood alcohol level that's measurable. Basically, we're just going to take away the words physician and dentist and add in the phrase pursuant to a lawful prescription. And the reason for that is, instead of listing everyone who can give a prescription, we figured that would cover everybody. And essentially what we're trying to do there is just add physician assistants and nurse practitioners into the group that people that could issue a prescription. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank the bringer of this amendment for bringing it. That's a much better way of wording it, and I would urge your support of the amendment.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 13 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill number 13 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 17. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 17, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to environmental quality, carbon sequestration, financial assurances, and regulation. This bill was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Baby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. This bill was further referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, excused, Phelps. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 17 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Oh, actually, those are Appropriations Committees. I'll just stop it. I move for the bill, and Appropriations can move their own amendments. And I'll turn it over to Representative Lubnow for the explanation.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the last major piece of the carbon sequestration suite of bills. Two sessions ago, we passed House Bill 90, the regulatory bill. In that bill, we created a task force, and the task force has worked for 2 years and created what, in my way of thinking, is a marvelous work product. It is a primer on carbon sequestration. What we asked them to do was to assess the risks and determine what adequate financial assurances would be. When we did the regulatory bill 2 years ago, we just stuck a placeholder in the bill called the sequester must put up adequate financial assurances, and that was a placeholder. House Bill 17 fills that place. If you look at the bill, on page 1 at the bottom, we create a monitoring account. That's not a liability or a risk assurance account. That's just a monitoring account that pays for all of the monitoring activities for the state of Wyoming so that geologic carbon sequestration is revenue neutral. Paragraph A talks about the investment of the account. Paragraph B talks about the only purposes that that account can be used for, which is to measure, monitor, and verify Wyoming geologic sequestration sites. That carries on to paragraph C where it says funds shall only be used for that purposes. Then section 2 amends of the bill on the middle or bottom of page 3 amends our permitting requirements so that the administrator of the Water Quality Division can promulgate rules and set permitting requirements. And the requirements for the permits, such applications shall include liability insurance for the operations. There are major insurance products that have been developed based upon the Wyoming scheme of things. At the bottom of the page is the bonding process. Subparagraph A on the bottom of page 4 is how to set the bonds. Subparagraph B in the middle of page 5 is making sure that the financial assurances are adequate and requiring annual reports on those financial assurances. Subparagraph C is procedures to adjust the bonds. Over on page 6 is replacement bonds if the bonding facility goes bad. Paragraph 7 is procedures for bond forfeiture. Subparagraph F is bond release on the on the bottom of page 6. And then it talks about in the middle of page 7 what those financial assurances are to insure for, and that's to not harm or present a risk to human health, safety, or the environment, including drinking water supplies, consistent with the purposes of this chapter and the rules and regulations adopted by the council. The philosophy, I think, should be that if you can't put up the financial insurances, we don't want you to do it in a state. Paragraph G in the middle of page 7 just requires that if a carbon sequestration facility is permitted, that you alert people by recording the notice that this pore space has been used for carbon storage. Paragraph 7 is the fees to go to the geologic sequestration account, the monitoring account. It's a per tonnage fee. And then Section 3 repeals the placeholder. Section 4 creates a position. The Standing Committee Amendment takes that position from the standard budget and puts it in the exception budget. With that, I'd stand for any questions.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I have is the necessity of the full-time position that we're authorizing. I understand the necessity to be forward-thinking in our carbon sequestration laws that we've been passing, but we don't really have a carbon sequestration industry right now, and do we really need to authorize the position at this time?
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The testimony of the Department of Environmental Quality at the Judiciary Committee hearing, and I wasn't able to attend the Appropriations Committee hearing, so if somebody wants to supplement what I'm telling you with what they heard, please feel free, was that the Department of Environmental Quality needed that full-time position. The reason they needed the full-time position was they needed somebody with the exceptional ability to understand financial assurances and bonding and stay ahead of the curve in establishing those before we had a project come in so that we knew what the bonding was. And this is complicated because you just these days can't go out and buy a bond. Since 9/11, that's been nearly impossible. So what companies have been doing is putting up property for bonds, their own property or other assets, and pledging assets, and making sure that we had an analyst available that could do that and ensure the bonds were adequate before anything happened so that if a project comes to this state, we are able to assess and have in place the criteria for establishing those bonds prior to the project happening was what the DEQ's testimony was.
Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for the representative from Campbell County. Page 7 regarding the safety risks, and it talks about including drinking water supplies, and I wonder what the specifics to that, if why we don't include just water supplies. We do use some water that's not fit for drinking for other purposes. And I wonder about the degradation of water from this process that, you know, that should be included as sort of a liability. The other question I have is just for the edification of the body here, is discussion of how we're sort of doing the risk analysis on this and how when we sort of do an analysis on what we're requiring for bonding and the financial assurances for this industry, How we are going to move forward in a carbon constrained, I guess, economy, and how do we really assess these risks if we have CO2 leaking from a reservoir, and hopefully the science figures out how not to do that. But the whole point of this bill is that we cover that. What penalties and what, you know, is there a penalty per ton of CO2, and how do those actually get assessed till you figure out the size of this bonding and the financial assurances?
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to the question regarding drinking water, these provisions are part of the Underground Injection Control Program, the purpose of which is to protect drinking water supply, so that's the primary focus of the program. I'm not quite sure I understood the second question, but in terms of enforcement, if there's leaking CO2, if there's migration beyond the permit side, or the CO, there's a release that otherwise violates the permit requirements. That's covered by the enforcement provisions of the Environmental Quality Act, and the penalty can be up to $10,000 per day per violation. But the whole point of the bonding insurance program designed by this bill is to make sure that there's adequate financial assurance in place in the event that the permittee is not financially capable. I mean, the first line of attack is if there's a problem, the permittee addresses it. The second line of attack is if the permittee is gone and insolvent, you go to the bond.
Chairman Childers. Oh, Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up. I guess my question is you know, if we have a reservoir that leaks and we've pumped $200 million worth of CO2 under the ground, how are those values of that risk, that analysis set and bonded at? You know, are they capped at a certain level of $5 million, you know, and maybe we've got $200 million worth of CO2 we've pumped underground and it's escaped somehow. God, I hope that wouldn't happen, but I'm curious to see how this all shakes out, and maybe we just don't know.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I refer to the body to the September 2009 report that the working committee, the Carbon Sequestration Working Group, put together, where they put together an assessment of the risks, a marvelous assessment of the risks, and even went so far as estimating cost ranges in today's dollars for those risks and what the bonding requirements should be in today's dollars. And they did that through talking with geologists, hydrogeologists, and then insurance experts and actuaries who were able to assess the risks and quantify them. And I don't want to read the whole report to you. I can hand it out to you. But if you look on page 61, for example, they talk about plume migration outside the permitted area. And they say that costs of mitigation, injectate excursions beyond permit boundaries, category costs range from $35,000 to $5 million more per event. And then they assess the bond at $5 million more per event. And then they talk about unpermitted leakage of carbon dioxide contaminants into an aquifer. And they assess that at $15 million, and they give the methodology for doing that. With respect to leakage of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and I will tell you that since we've started this endeavor, the technology has evolved a lot more than it did 2 years ago when I first talked to you. And I've had the opportunity to meet with some nice folks, including the hydrogeologists from Stanford University who've been doing this for 20 years. And what they tell me is that in large measure, large-scale leakage is not going to happen, and that even if you wanted to get the carbon dioxide out, because of the capillary action in the rock, 80% of it's going to be entrained in the rock. So if you have a leak, it would be maybe 20% of the carbon dioxide leaking out. Now, the liability associated with that would be the liability to pay back any tax credits or carbon cap credits or whatever somebody imposes for the carbon storage. That's above our pay grade, because we're not capping carbon dioxide. And so how to pay that back and what those liabilities are and who gets paid back is above our pay grade. But we want to have a bonding for it so that we're not liable for it and so that somebody does get paid back. And that's part of what's contained in here. With respect to reservoir leaks and cross-aquifer migration, there is an issue, and it's an issue that needs to be studied about formation, pressurization, and what to do with that water. The Wyoming State Geologist has talked about bringing the water up, treating it, sending the bad stuff back down with the carbon dioxide into the formation from whence it came and selling the water to somebody who needs the water. I don't know how practical that is, but that's a solution proposed by the Wyoming State Geologist. Those questions will have to be answered before any of these things get done, which is why later on in the session we'll be talking about research funds, which is probably inappropriate for a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. I hope that I've answered your questions and stand for any others.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a corrected copy of the No, never mind. Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask the gentleman from Gillette. A lot of these regulations you're developing, we still don't mention the other types of carbon sequestration that are available. And we had a fairly lengthy presentation at one of the councils that Wyoming belongs to, and meeting in Colorado Springs, where we talked about especially algae for carbon sequestration, and they also mentioned some other means. And all I want to know is, are we flexible enough in these regulations to accommodate those other types of sequestration?
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These regulations only address geologic carbon sequestration, which is pumping it underground. We don't have any regulations at this point on algae, and algae is kind of an interesting thing because when algae does eat the carbon dioxide, it sequesters it until you burn the algae, or it decomposes when it releases it back into the atmosphere again. So it can be a long-term storage device if you keep the algae from decomposing or keep it in biomass form, but if you use it for fuel or allow it to decompose, then it releases carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, which is an interesting same thing with trees. Trees are a short-term, in geologic time, sequestration device, unless they turn into biomass, get covered by dirt, get pressurized, and then they turn into desk decorations. But that's another story. So the short answer to your question was these regulations don't address algae or terrestrial sequestration through biomass.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my apologies for the delay. We have two amendments, and the first one is that I'd like to move is House Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 17. And that, all it does on page 9 is on line 4, it changes from a standard budget item to an exception budget item. And I think you've probably heard some discussion about this project, and that it, because it's new and that it's just starting up, that we in appropriations felt it's important for the group to come back and report to us next year when we're doing the supplemental on those expenses and the progress that they are making. So I'd ask for a favorable aye.
Question having been called, although we're on standing committee amendment number 1, question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing and committee amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 17. This has to deal with the position that has been explained to you earlier, the fiscal analyst. And what we have been doing in JAC is reviewing the vacancies for all of the agencies. And I think we've visited about this previously, but we've reduced some vacancies of 50 positions at this point, and we're now analyzing each of the agencies again as we go through budget requests. So this is a vacancy that the agency had as a technology position, and what we're doing is we're moving this fiscal analyst into that position with some additional monies, but less than what was requested by the agency to do this work. And since they're in a startup position, we felt that this would work, and again, they would have to come back and report to us as they make their progress. If there are no questions, I would ask for a favorable aye.
We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. We have yet another employee in the Wyoming DEQ, and I'm just curious, how many have we added over the last 5 years? I can see them adding during the run-up of the mineral production, but things are kind of slowing down now. It seems like I'm sure there's probably expertise that could put this under their belt, and then we could add to that when the time comes that they need these additional employees. So I just don't know how wise it is to add employees in this group at this point. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to respond to the good gentleman from Riverton, this has been a consistent question that we have been asking over the last 2 months in regard to positions in agencies and in particular to DEQ. As we realize that production has gone down, what they were doing with those employees that address permit issues. Some of those positions, although that's not germane to what we're talking about here, but just to give you that explanation, is that they are doing finishing permitting, actually, and what's happened is from the federal government with several new regulations that are being put on them, it seems that their time is being spent extensively now working on the long term of the permits that they've already issued. But in particular with this position, that's why we came up with it. We had reduced any position that was over 24 months with an agency. We have eliminated those. That's why you would see a difference in the balance of the budget that we have been talking about over the last couple of weeks from when the governor proposed his budget was because of a reduction in vacancies to all these agencies. So, you know, I feel that we have spent quite a bit of time scrutinizing these positions, and that's why you'll see another bill coming forth next week that we're doing the same thing. So we have to be cautious as we do this because it can restrain the agencies as they're working on some of these positions that they're now out looking to fill because there's been a hiring freeze and there's been somewhat of a let up on that. So it's been pretty restrictive. So I think the committee felt fairly comfortable about this position and moving it there. And I think because this is such a critical issue to the state of Wyoming and the investment that we are making long term, that we felt that we needed to roll this position over and again review it next December when we look at the supplemental.
We're on committee of the whole amendment number one, Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some more clarification. Basically, there's 271 employees now, I think, in that department, and your exact question was asked. We've seen a reduction, but really haven't seen much, we're told, reduction in really the workload. This is not a new position, and you're going to see a lot. I just tell the members you're going to see this is kind of new territory. That's why it took a while to get the language right, but we're going to see a lot of this, I think, reclassified because we cut all positions over 2 years. Anything's been open 2 years, boom, gone. And by reclassifying this, one that was like 18 months been open, then we still keep them under the governor's hiring freeze. If we just cut that and add one, then they kind of can get around that deal. So we're going to, me personally speaking as one member, we're going to, and I think committee, going to try to add no net new positions, reclassify, and make them prioritize. So I think we did a good thing. And, you know, one of the members said, you know, you invest in one of these folks over 20 years, it's a $2 million investment to the state. So we're going to try to. A good representative from Washakie pointed that out. So we're going to try to really hold the line on positions. Thank you.
We're on committee of the whole amendment number one. There's no more discussion. All those in favor of committee of the whole amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we've had some of our best legal minds working on this issue and these bills, and I guess my question goes towards, as our state moves towards a pilot demonstration phase of this, and how do we answer the questions if, in fact, the state is the permit holder, and how does that interact with this bill in front of us?
Representative Lubnow.
Mr. Chairman, as you'll recall, and I think we addressed this last session, I hope, we have provisions for a temporary permit holder and for the Department of Environmental Quality until these regulations get into place to issue temporary permits. When the state of Wyoming is the permit holder, they will have to either go through this process or work under the temporary permit process if this one doesn't get in place soon enough. So they are a permit holder just like anybody else, and there is no exemption. And if you can't do it, and you can't put up the bonds, and you can't do it responsibly. We don't want you doing it.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 17 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 17 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 16. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 16, introduced by Representative Buchanan, an act relating to private school licensing. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeters, signed Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 16 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I will turn it over to the good majority floor leader from House District 54. He is the one that brought the Standing Committee Amendment, and it's his bill. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you House Bill 16, and I will kind of explain the Standing Committee Amendment as I go along. It'll make more sense that way. Back in 2004, we amended the private school licensing exemptions to clarify exemption requirements, and we also imposed additional requirements upon exempt post-secondary religious schools. And in 2006, we made another change to the law in our effort to crack down on diploma mills that were popping up within the state. And in 2006, if you look under 21-2406, we deleted through that legislation basically any reference to any religious post-secondary education degree institution. And what that basically did, I like to say that the best explanation is we threw the baby out with the bathwater. We've got a few, three, I think, schools within the state of Wyoming that are bricks and mortar schools, face-to-face instruction, resembling nothing like a diploma mill. And so, after a couple of years, the Department of Education and some of these schools started communicating and realized that they were in violation of the law. And basically that occurred this past fall, and I became the sponsor of this bill because one of these schools resides in my home county. And so what the bill before you does is basically brings back in some of the exemption requirements that we deleted in 2006. And what it does is it brings back some things that the Department of Education felt were necessary to, number one, bring these schools back into compliance with the law, two, obviously allow them to continue operation, and three, maintain the strength of the law such that diploma mills didn't move back into the state. So, what the amendment does, the Standing Committee Amendment number one does, is it adds that first section there, page 2, line 10, and provides that these schools cannot provide any distance education. That guarantees that there's not any of this online degree granting going on and online education. It's face-to-face instruction. It's bricks and mortar. Then on the amendment on line 8, you see the Roman numeral 1, and this is something the Department of Education wanted so that it was clear that on diplomas and degrees and on course transcripts, only certain language could appear on there as far as what a student might earn from one of these schools. And then if you look down on line 20, that Roman numeral 2 refers to some tax language
that requires these institutions to annually file with the department evidence of nonprofit religious organization status for purposes of federal taxation and organization under the laws of our state. And so the amendment basically was offered to, as a, I guess, in an agreement with the Department of Education, like I said, to allow these schools to once again be in compliance with the law, yet maintain the strength of our laws when it comes to preventing diploma mills operating within the state. I would stand for any questions.
Questions on the amendment? Oh. Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted, and we're back on the bill. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't like to stand up and take time, but I want to tell you this is a really good bill. Very good bill. These people that we're talking about are really good community people. They do a lot. We had a lot of good testimony about all the things that they do for us. And the one in particular in the good majority floor leaders community has been there for better than, I think it was 40 years, I believe. And it's just great that our Department of Ed worked with them and worked with the majority floor leader to craft the language. And I urge your support for the bill.
Chairman Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give also just a little bit of history so that you understand. I'm in communication with the president of the school that's in Goshen County, and I said, well, you can offer a certificate of completion, can you not? And he said, yeah, we can. And I said, well, what, isn't that as good as a diploma since it's not credited or anywhere else? And the answer he gave me, they could. But many mission boards where many of these students go require a diploma. And he said also the parents that send those kids there like to see a diploma. And I thought that was enough reason.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Or? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so at the recommendation that House Bill Number 16 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed, no. House Bill Number 16 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 41. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 41, introduced by the Education Committee, an act relating to school finance distance education. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubnow, McKim, McComey, Teeter. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 41 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. And, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the good gentleman from House District 21, the Valley of the Cheese.
Representative McKim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 41 actually corrects an error that arises when one school district in Wyoming contracts with the second district to provide virtual or distant learning education services for a student. Now, under the current law, any student or any district in Wyoming can provide distance education as long as the course meets state standards and the teacher that's the teacher of record is a Wyoming certified teacher. Now, we have approximately 400 students that receive all their education online through the virtual school in Wyoming. Not all school districts, however, can provide virtual education, a full-time virtual education. When students in these districts, along with their parents, want to pursue full-time distance education, The resident district will contract with another district to provide those services. Now, this is where the problem occurs. The resident district will pay tuition to the district offering the services. Unfortunately, the funds received by the second district is counted as a local resource when computing the district's block grant guarantee. The result is that the district actually educating the child is out of those resources needed to fund the online education. Now, this glitch in our financial financial system is corrected by House Bill 41, which simply excludes tuition payments received from distance education services as being counted against the district as part of their local resources. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand for questions. And if there's no questions, I'll move the bill.
Is there any discussion? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 41 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 41 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 2. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2, introduced by the Agriculture Committee. An act relating to veterinarians. This bill was referred to Committee number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlick, Teeters, Wallace, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlick, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee the whole rises to report it, do it so with the recommendation that bill number 2 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there's a standing committee amendment, which I would move at this time. Standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 2. This amendment came at the request of the representative from the Attorney General's office. That asked that we would remove on page 2 of the bill in the section on definitions 3330202. This definition is in the Veterinary Practice Act, and they just asked that it thought it would be appropriate if we would just remove that from the bill, as it really did not pertain to the more core issue that's in the bill. So there's no questions. I'd ask a call for the question on the standing committee amendment.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The standing committee amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For an explanation of the bill, I turn it over to the good representative from House District 43.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my privilege to tell you all about the five-word change we're about to do here. Basically, what we have done as a committee is we have taken out the accredited veterinary college statute and put license to practice in the state of Wyoming. What we found after we passed this bill several years ago is that we do have some people moving to our state from other places, from Europe, from foreign countries, and they have gotten veterinary degrees from non-accredited colleges. These people still have to pass not only the national board exam, they have a separate national exam if they come in from a non-accredited college, and they have to pass the state board exam. The people in charge of administering the state-level board exam have assured us that it is comprehensive and thorough, and they support this change. I would stand for any questions, but would ask you to support the bill.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlick's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 2 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 26. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 26, introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to the administration of government medical review panel. This bill was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Harvey, Kimball, Landon, Millen, Shepperson, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 26 do pass. I further move Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 26.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I'm without my Standing Committee Amendment.
Oh, you want mine?
Thank you. I'd like to give a little bit of background. As you may recall, we had a constitutional amendment that was approved in November of 2004 that allowed the legislature to enact laws requiring alternate dispute resolution or a medical review panel before a person files a lawsuit against a health care provider for injury or death. The Medical Review Panel Act was adopted then in 2005 by the legislature. The as I said during the introduction of this bill, the committee wanted to review the efficacy of the medical review panel process and to determine what our experience to date was and whether or not it could be improved. Just for a little refresher on the process is the claim and medical information medical information release form is filed with the medical review office. And that is sent by certified mail then to the health care providers. A request is sent from the Wyoming Bar and the health care provider licensing authority to list 12 potential members to be on this medical review panel. After this claim has been filed, that tolls the statute of limitation for the malpractice case for a specific period of time. The healthcare, then as this is starting to move forward, the director in the medical review panel office requests the records from the healthcare provider and other healthcare providers that have to do with this claim. And copies of those medical records are made and sent to all parties. Whenever this action starts to take place, the healthcare provider has 60 days to file an answer. And now, simultaneously with the healthcare provider filing his answer for this claim, the claimant is required to file a report from expert witnesses supporting his claim within 60 days. And that has been problematic. So that is the first proposal in this bill to amend our current statutes. And you'll see at the top of page 2 what the proposal is that the claimant would submit after they've gotten an answer from the healthcare provider, then it's likely that the claimant will have the records and everything he needs to give to an expert to his expert witness. And so instead of those things being filed simultaneously, the problem with that is the healthcare provider might just use this process to find out more information and get that expert report from the claimant, and then he would just quit the drop the case and perhaps never even answer. And so this requires the healthcare provider to answer the claim, and then once the claimant has that answer, then he can take that information and give that to an expert witness who then has an opportunity or find an expert witness, give them the information, and give that expert witness time to make a report and answer back. This is thought to be something that just levels the playing field. This also comes in on part of the Standing Committee Amendment, which I would like to direct your attention to, is in the bill that process is written to happen within 15 days. And testimony revealed that that was too short a time. By the time a claimant gets that information, gives it to an expert witness, and gets an answer back, it really requires more time. So you'll see the first lines in the Standing Committee Amendment, lines 1 through 8, delete the 15 days and return the and set the time for the claimant to send in his expert witness information and so on to 60 days. That's the first change that we're proposing in this bill. The after that takes place, once the claimant makes a claim and that information is received by the director of the medical review panel, three things can happen. The health care provider is not required to answer. He doesn't have to. We didn't want to make that mandatory. And if he doesn't answer, then this order is dismissed. And the claimant can go ahead and file suit. Or both parties can jointly agree not to go any further with this and waive the hearing to the panel. Or finally, the case can go ahead to the panel for a hearing. And just to give you a quick reminder on that, if they do have a panel for hearing, how that works is it's scheduled. They determine what medical records are necessary, and those are received. A hearing date is set. The medical review panel director chooses two health care providers and two attorneys for each panel. And then they, in turn, also choose a lay member. So the panel is made up of five members. They have an informal hearing. And the panel deliberates and prepares orders, and it's sent to both parties. That there are standard to review for reviews in here. There are standards as far as substantial evidence goes and reasonable probability and so on. And then the panel issues a written decision. The decision is not binding on either party and does not prevent the case from going to district court. In order to preserve a more informal process, encourage communication and understanding between the parties, and hopefully we hope that this process results in some resolution without a court case, is the second part of what we have in the bill is an amendment that we're proposing. And that has to do, and in fact, I need to drop back a little bit, but I'll cover this second part first. And that has to do with the inadmissibility of the findings of the medical review panel. Right now, neither party is really sure where the findings of the medical review panel are going and whether the court is going to use them. And that has created a certain amount of uncertainty, and it's thought that if that is taken out, then claimants and defendants both will be more likely to use the medical review panel proposal or the medical review panel process. I jumped ahead of myself a little bit in the bill, or actually that is found on that amendment is found on the bottom of page 2, where it talks about the decision of the panel and any material submitted to the panel may be admissible. We're saying no. We've inserted language at the top of page 3 that says the claim, answer, and decision shall not be admissible. The next part of the bill that we changed has to do with starting on page 3, line 15. This, for the next couple pages, an amendment was offered during interim to address the cost of the medical review panel. And trying to also make it more fair if it was taken to court afterwards. But we really, looking at that longer, we thought that there's a lot of potential problems in it. It didn't address what would happen if it settles before a court appearance. We weren't sure about some of the whether some of the provisions were constitutionally sound. So we struck that part, and you will see that also in the standing committee amendment, starting at line 8, where we just delete entirely from line 16 on down on page 3, all of line page 4, and all the language on page 5. And so that covers the standing committee amendment. And so at this time, I'd stand for any questions on the standing committee amendment before returning to the bill.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm concerned that the tail's wagging the dog here, and that we have a process that was maybe largely irrelevant that we're trying to make relevant by forcing people to use it. We have a process now where after receiving an expert report, the physician can read the expert report and waive out of the process. And we created the panel because physicians were concerned about frivolous lawsuits. Well, if there's an expert report, and if they read it and think, well, we're going to court anyway, why don't I waive out of this process? Because the point wasn't going through the process. It was eliminating the frivolous lawsuits by forcing an expert opinion to be rendered prior to going to court. Well, if the physician doesn't want to use the panel because they've had the opportunity to review the expert report and they want to waive out of it and go to court, why are we forcing them to file an answer and go through the panel? That would be the question related to that amendment.
Chairman Landon.
I don't think that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The process wouldn't change. Right now, the way that that it works is that expert report, it's mainly the timing that's changing in this. It appeared to us, from our understanding of this, is the expert report was occurring at the very same time or even before the claimant had an answer from the medical provider. So it seemed like the claimant was working without full information, full medical records on was kind of what our understanding was, and without the answer, he was trying to put together an expert witness and an expert report, and without that, is the expert report didn't really have the capability of focusing exactly on what the medical provider was providing in his answer. And so it wasn't that he wasn't going to have to do it. It was a matter of timing, of waiting until the answer before he provided it.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is that when we originally did this, my recollection is we made the decision admissible, the stricken language, admissible in whole or in part in a subsequent trial of the matter, subject to discussion of the trial court. And my recollection is the purpose of that was to make it admissible for impeachment. With that stricken, then my question is, what if there's a material deviation
between testimony given to the panel or before the panel and testimony given in court? And is there a mechanism left here to impeach that witness's testimony in court with previously given testimony that was inconsistent before the panel?
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, you might be able to judge the consequences of that better than I, but the reason that that was desired to be changed was that right now the going before the medical review panel turns out to be a very time-consuming, detailed preparation and process that prevent some people going to it just because it is very expensive and as you might say, letter perfect. And the idea was to have a more informal process, hopefully getting the issues out on the table, getting the two parties communicating, and seeing whether or not, not only whether or not the case was up to the standards of going forward, but also to determine what the to have that information and that lesser standard, with the idea that this might drive a settlement without going all the way to the court process.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to talk against the bill right now. I just ask the body to leave a marker right there. I'm going to bring a second reading amendment, assuming this passes committee of the whole. I'm going to bring a second reading amendment that designed to say that representations and testimony given before the panel that are inconsistent with testimony given at trial can be used for purposes of impeachment. What I'm worried about is somebody goes in front of the panel and lies and then goes to court and tells the truth, or the opposite. They go to the panel and tell the truth, then they get to court and they lie, and there's no mechanism for confronting them in court with the inconsistency between those two testimonies. So I'll bring an amendment that will square that issue up for consideration.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, we did not consider that issue, and it sounds rational, and I would invite such an amendment.
You have heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question?
Yes.
Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The standing committee amendment number one has been adopted, and we're back on the bill. Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that by going through the bill and explaining the standing committee amendment and doing that in step-by-step process, I think that that also provided the understanding of the amendments to the medical review panel process that are being proposed in this bill. So unless there's questions about that, I'd call for the question on the bill.
You ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 26 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 26 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 32. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 32, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to professions and occupations, Board of Nursing, continuing jurisdiction. This bill was sent to the Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Harvey, Kimball, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Excused, Hallinan. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 32 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I would pass the explanation over to the... Excuse me. There is a standing committee amendment, number one, which I will move at this time. That standing committee amendment just changed the enactment date from the usual and customary July 1st to effective immediately. And I will pass the explanation of the bill and the standing committee amendment over to the good representative from the center of the state.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe we can just deal with the standing committee amendment real quickly first before I do the explanation of the bill.
Heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm honored to be able to bring you the last bill of the day on this Friday, the first Friday of the session. Before you, House Bill 32 is an act to extend the jurisdiction of the Board of Nursing to make sure that nurses who should not be practicing in this state do not practice in this state and don't practice in our neighboring states. It's interesting as you look at some of the stories related to nurses who have lost their licenses. You're reminded of the fact that nurses are in a unique position of being entrusted with the most vulnerable members of our society, folks that often can't do even the most basic functions of daily activity themselves. We entrust them to the nurses, and so it is extremely important that we have a system that we can trust and a system that ensures that the nurses who are practicing in this state know what they're doing and do a good job and treat their patients appropriately. There has been a problem in our system over the last several years because of this problem of continuing jurisdiction. And the system is this. Nurses, on a two-year rotating basis, renew their license. So at the end of every even-numbered year, their licenses renew. The problem is if there is a pending complaint or pending charge that hasn't been wrapped up at the time, the nurse just simply chooses not to renew their license, the board, under the current language of statute, loses their jurisdiction. And that case simply goes away, no matter how egregious, no matter how terrible the charge that has been made, the case just goes away. Now, when the system works right and a nurse makes their way through the system, if they have acted improperly and their license is taken away, they're reported on a national database that every state has access to, so when they move to the next state, that state knows that the license has been removed and why that license has been removed. When they simply let their licenses expire, they can disappear, go to another state, begin practicing again as if nothing ever happened. And so this is really to get at that issue and that problem. And there is as my fellow colleague from Natrona County says, there's a one-pager in front of you that's entitled House Bill 32 that kind of goes through some of the salient points on this legislation. But the statistics are, I think, fairly impressive that over those licensing years ending in 2006 and ending in 2008, there was 40 different cases in which the Board of Nursing lost jurisdiction, and those cases just simply went away. And those cases involved such things as nurses abusing drugs while they're working with patients. They involved things like nurses stealing from the patient, very patients they were, whose care was entrusted to them. They involved such things as neglecting patients and even some horrible allegations of abuse of patients. And yet those nurses let their licenses expire, went away, and it never ends up on a national database, and there's no action taken on their license. This bill, before you, would take care of that problem. Looking specifically at the bill, if you look at page 2, subsection, or Romanet 10, that is the provision that allows for continuing jurisdiction. And, again, it's important to remember we're only looking at conduct and acts by these nurses at the time they were licensed. It simply says that by letting their license expire, they don't get to escape the jurisdiction of the Board of Nursing. And that any pending claims and charges, the Board of Nursing can continue to prosecute to their conclusion and, if necessary, report them on the national database. If you look at Romanet 9, this is a little bit different provision, but it's aimed at the same problem. And essentially what it does is it affects the timing of the authority of the Board of Nursing to issue subpoenas. Typically, they have had to wait until a formal charge is actually filed to subpoena documents and begin investigation of a case. And that tends to stretch out a case a long time and, again, leads to problems with losing jurisdiction. This allows them to, before even a formal charge is filed, be able to subpoena documents, do their investigation, and hopefully ferret out those cases that don't merit further investigation and formal charges, get rid of those cases and focus on the ones that are important. I think this bill does a good job of making sure that those in our state who are in charge of making sure that nurses who are practicing here are doing a good job and are qualified to do it. It gives them the tools to do that, and I would just encourage your aye vote on the bill.
Seeing no discussion, are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 32 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 32 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The motion carries.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 22, recommended do pass. House Bill 31, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 36, amended, recommended, do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Joint Resolution 4, recommended, do pass. House Bill 37, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 12, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 13, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 17, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 16, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 41, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 26, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 32, amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Barbudo, Chairman.
Representative Barbudo.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole report is approved. Thank you, Representative Barbudo. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 3, Apiary Laws, ayes 29, excused 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 4, Special District Elections, ayes 29, excused 1, signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 5, Special Districts, Public Records, ayes 29, excused 1, signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 103, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 6, Improvement and Service Districts, ayes 29, excused 1, signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 104, Mr. Speaker, the bills as to below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 10, State Parks, Bear River State Park, Ayes 26, Noes 3, Excused 1, signed Diane Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 105, Mr. Speaker, the bills as to below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 16, Property Tax Review of Assessment, Ayes 29, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 106, Mr. Speaker, the bills as to below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 11, State Parks Acquisition and Disposition of Lands, Ayes 17, Noes 12, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 107, Mr. Speaker, the bills as below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 12, State Parks and Historic Sites, Boundaries and Designations. Ayes 26, Noes 3, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 108, Mr. Speaker, the listed bills as below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 14, Circuit Court Hearings of Municipal Violations by Juveniles. Ayes 29, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 109, Mr. Speaker, the bills as to below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 17, Statement of Consideration. Ayes 19, Noes 10, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 110, Mr. Speaker, the bills as to below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 40, Establishment of Highways. Ayes 17, Noes 12, Excused 1, signed Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 61, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, No, Quarberg, Excused, Throne, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 64, respectfully reports back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Quarberg, Throne, No, Peasley, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 66, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarberg, Throne, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Joint Resolution 2, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickrey, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarberg, Throne, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 46, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, Excused, Phelp, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 88, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, Excused, Phelp, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 110, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeters, No, Brechtel, signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 56, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeters, signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 84, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, McKim, No, Madden, Peterson, Swanitzer, Dave, excused. Hallen N. Signed, representing Cohey, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 44, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 72, reports back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. Committee announcements. Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Monday, February 15th, 8 a.m. and H-10 to consider the following bills. House Joint Resolution 8, Opposition to Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, and House Bill 77, Youth Archery Licenses.
Chairman Illaway.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet Monday upon noon recess. We'll discuss 4 bills, House Bill 70, Vacant Land, House Bill 23, Business Entities, Reinstatement Fees, House Bill 69, Secretary of State Directives Authority, and House Bill 124, Lien Statement Notice. And, Mr. Speaker, while I'm here, a privilege of the floor, you all got an announcement about the Historical Society, the Laramie County Historical Society, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say the American Heritage Center, since the reading clerk and I are on the board of advisors, that at 2 p.m. in the county library, there will be an excellent presentation on missionary work that was done at the turn of the century in Wyoming. If you want to do something with your wife at 2 o'clock on Valentine's Day, we'd love to have you. There will be refreshments. And y'all take care, because my understanding is that there is a storm in western Wyoming. So happy Valentine's Day.
You may have privilege of the floor. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet upon adjournment Monday in room H-10, where we will take up House Bill 109, Compulsory School Attendance 3, and House Bill 120, Student Assessment Measures.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet at 7:30 a.m. room H-18 to consider the following 4 bills, and we're going to rock and roll. It's House Bill 67, Data Processing Center Sales and Use Tax Exemption, House Bill 57, Damage to Underground Public Utilities, House Bill 93, OSHA Penalties, and House Bill 97, Nuclear Energy Production Study. And one other thing, Mr. Speaker, if I may, we will reschedule the normal Friday meeting to Thursday, so we'll have a meeting on Wednesday and Thursday for all those who are interested in following the Minerals Committee.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Monday morning, 7:30. There were a bit of a change from the noon announcement. We will not be looking at natural gas evaluation. That will be referred to Wednesday. But we will discuss WIND 101, Taxation of Digital Products, House Bill 29, House Bill 106, Small Business Investment Credit, and House Bill 33, Property Tax Levy Date. If time permits, then we'll be looking at House Bill 96 and House Bill 100. They are sales tax on railroad repair stock and ethanol tax credits.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, We'll be meeting on Monday morning at 8 a.m. in room H8, taking up the following bills: House Bill 19, Mandatory Savings Accounts for Inmates; House Bill 20, Criminal Street Gangs; House Bill 71, Workers' Compensation Appeals; and House Joint Resolution 9, Resolution to Amend United States Constitution.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, will meet Monday upon adjournment in room H17 to hear House Bill 86, Medicaid, Elderly Care, and House Bill 127, Medicaid Applications 2.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Tuesday, February 16th, 8 a.m., room 302. Note that room change will... consider House Bill 102, Livestock and Brands, and House Bill 54, Wyoming Food Freedom Act. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet Monday morning, 8 a.m. with the Senate. We will be going over the working document of the budget and the Section 300. Any of you are welcome to come and hear our conversation. The chairs are hard, but we'd love to have your visit. Happy Valentine's Day.
Representative Pedersen.
Mr. Speaker, may I have privilege?
Please.
I meant to remind you all earlier, but during session, all of you members are members of our local country clubs. You can take your sweethearts out there this weekend, and anybody who asks real nicely, I'll give you the chairman of corporation's number.
That's very kind of you, Representative Illaway. Any other announcements? Excuse me, Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to remind everybody that please do not put your flowers on the wooden tops of the desks. If the water spills, it's oak. It will damage that portion of the desk. So would really appreciate it. And, again, happy Valentine's Day, Mr. Speaker.
I already have a Valentine, thanks. No, thank you, Representative Illaway. You too. Good work this week, ladies and gentlemen. It was, I thought it ran very smoothly and everybody was ready to go and prepared with what they were doing. Next week will be a busy week in committee and a busy week in committee of the whole. So be prepared for that. Get some sleep. Stay on the road when you're driving. When you're not, stay off the road. But have a great weekend, and we will end. We'll go ahead and recess, and then Representative Thompson is going to lead us in Cowgirl Joe, Cowboy Cowgirl Joe. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Permission briefly for privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
In the South Gallery, I have a guest today, the amazing Riley Hankins from Phoenix, Arizona, who's a student of American government politics, likes presidential biographies. And she came down and was here today and is going to be here Monday observing what we do. So just wanted to say thanks to her for coming to see me.
Hey! Welcome, Riley. Welcome to the House.
And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until February 15, 2010 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The House is adjourned. Representative Thompson.